Hello and welcome to the Creighton Crowbar. This is episode 15 and today is Tuesday, October 22nd. I'm Graham Smith and I'm joined here with...
Marge Davis.
Tom Senior.
And Chris Thurston.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hello. Right. Hello.
Do we have any news to discuss today? I can't remember.
What
was it?
What happened? What happened today? I want to talk about early access and how crap it is.
Yeah. It's become... I agree. There's been a massive escalation in how crap early access is in the last week, as far as I'm concerned. To the point where, just from my point of view now, I'm actually thinking of rethinking again how a PC gamer handles alpha reviews and stuff, because there's so many of them, and they're mostly shit. I think we've both had a similar experience with this week.
Yeah, well, actually, my first experience, the shitty taste of a pre-alpha build was with Audio Surf 2, and that came out on Early Access. And what's remarkable about all of these Early Access games is they aren't cheap, really. You're not really getting a bargain in return for an unfinished product. You're beta testing for free and paying maybe 10 quid. I can't remember how much Audio Surf costs now, but it was more than I would happily lose down the back of a sofa. And it was in such a state, like the menus just don't work. They look, it's like Windows is broken when you load it up. and the main game type, which is the only one which is unlocked from start, is just really, ill considered. And I don't want to particularly get into the details of Audio Surf, but that seems to be like a characteristic which is now replicating itself against, again, lots of early access games. And I quite like it when I could pay for games that were finished.
Exactly. Or at least you knew that you weren't trying to judge it against some kind of nebulous future quality that might not ever manifest. Like, I've been playing space-based DF9.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a... it was produced initially by Double Fine's Amnesia Fortnite thing, where they just gave themselves... Like, it was one of the games they made. And they've kind of refined it and polished it to an extent and put it out as a early access game that I think costs 20 quid. Like, it's full... I mean, this is the world we live in now, but that's full into, like, serious consideration territory. It costs the same, I think, as the full season of Wolf Among Us.
Wow, okay.
Right. It's kind of built as Dwarf Fortress in space. It's a base building kind of emergent strategy management game, where you're building a space station sort of thousands of years after galactic civilization has completely collapsed. It's the kind of the top level thing. And it is incredibly, incredibly limited in its current form. Like, once you've played it for about an hour and evaded any of the kind of pitfalls you can have, pirates can raid you, you can, come across a derelict and an alien attacks you and stuff like that. Once you've kind of seen all of those things once, you've seen everything there is. To the extent that, like, one of the room types you can build is a fusion reactor, and at the moment it costs nothing and does nothing, because it's just a placeholder. You don't need one.
See, I didn't even get that far in it. Because it looks really nice, incidentally. I like it. Visually, it totally lulled me into a false sense of competency. But then just the opening 5 to 10 minutes of that game, it's trying to lead you through what you need to do to set up a space station. But all of his instructions are wrong or vague.
Yeah.
Or a combination of the two. And so the first thing I ask you to do is build a room. And it says build a rectangular room. Doesn't tell you how big you need to build it. But it does need to be a certain size because you need to fit something in that room. But it doesn't tell you that until later. So I ended up kind of restarting the game multiple times because at every stage it was telling me to do something without the sufficient amount of information for me to get it right. And then, like, can you, for example, in a airlock, you build a room, then you specify its purpose, and then you build the things which are particular to that room in it. Yes. I don't know quite why it's broken down into lots of different stages, because it seems like, given the restrictions of where you can place the things, they really only happen in one specific room, so why not just, when you assign it, make them automatically build? Regardless, can you delete those specific things?
Yes.
Because it didn't tell me how, and I couldn't work out, because I accidentally put it in place of the place where I need to build a door, and then I had no idea how to remove it.
You have to go into the construction menu and then choose demolish, and that allows you to paint things that your builders will then go and disassemble.
Because I could only see it painting the actual walls rather than the actual
selection thing is really finicky. It was one of the many things about it that's slightly broken beyond the limited scope, which I guess is the first thing I landed on. Like, when it loads up, it suggests you watch this, like, 40-minute long video. I watched the first 10 minutes of it, and it prevented me from making almost all of those mistakes, because it shows you kind of roughly what the right layout is for an initial corridor and a life support room, which is where your oxygen generators are, and an airlock. But there's a load of weird problems that start off just feeling a kind of a little bit janky. When your little sort of starship denizens are outside the ship, they can go to an airlock, put on a spacesuit, go out the airlock and hover about outside doing build construction on the outside of the space station, or going off to mine an asteroid, which is kind of principal thing you do. Once they've done that, they get kind of free pathing through your space station. So if for example you've got a long rectangular space station and the airlock is at the furthest rightmost extent, and you give a guy an order to go and mine an asteroid that's on the other side of the space station on the left, he'll walk out the airlock and then sort of clip through the entire space station, sort of like floating down corridors where people are just milling around on the way. And it's because it doesn't seem to count the space station as an object for people who are in space, which is weird. And actually broke the game for me, because one of the things that can happen is derelict stations can kind of warp in, and you can send your security assigned guys to go and investigate them, and that might get you, in the best case scenario, you get more people out of it. You find people on board and they can come and join you. And then sometimes they're full of pirates or aliens. And I had a weird situation where the airlock to get into one of these derelicts was on the opposite side from the only way my guys could go to get into it, right? If they were traveling from my station to theirs, they'd have to go around it to get into an airlock on the other side. Because they don't go around it, they go through it. And while they're going through it, even though they're technically outside the station, they are vulnerable to be attacked by anyone inside. As if they're actually in those rooms. But because they're in their spacesuits, they are not actually capable of responding in any way to combat, because all the combat stuff happens when people are outside of spacesuits and have rifles and whatever. Or punch people. And so I lost, like, two security guys, because they magically clipped through the walls on the way into the station. And the only solution I could find was to flag the outer walls of that, the walls facing me of that derelict for, demolition. And so builders went over and demolished the walls, to expose it all to vacuum, because people could be sucked into space. At which point I learned that that particular kind of alien doesn't get affected by decompression at all. It just continues to walk around as if nothing had happened. And it's like, at that point, even though I get that it's an early access product, the very basic interactions you can expect aren't there, and therefore it is like fundamentally unsatisfying to progress in. And so the simple answer would be, don't release it to the public yet.
I think,
you know, it's quite, the presentation's quite nice, it's quite charming, the interface is actually really nice, I think, once you get used to it, apart from a few finicky things that could be improved. If I had, from a point of view of someone who's a game journalist, like, if I had played that in an alpha build for preview, and I was writing a preview about it, I'd probably be quite positive, because I'd see the potential with another year's work or something on just polish, even 6 months on polish and systems and stuff. But as it is, I feel the need to kind of condemn it, because it's charging people close, you know, a full price for something that is in every way inadequate.
Partly playing devil's advocate here, but isn't that mitigated by the fact that it is in the early access section? And so people know when they're buying those products that they're not necessarily getting something which is going to be fun at all, that they're buying into a process. And isn't this a way of countering the risk involved in making games? Like, it's not a case of, oh, they should have worked on it for longer before they released it. It's probably a case of they released it now because this was the point at which they had to release it, because they had to start recouping some of their expenses. And so if they didn't release it now, then they simply would not have made the game in the first place.
Right, but it's about the value proposition, to use a wanky term, that you offer. And most of these early access games aren't offering nearly good value to the players, I'd say.
Also, it's about how meaningfully you involve people in that process of testing a game. You know what I mean? Like, if that's what people are paying for ultimately, is kind of this sort of insider loop on the development of a game. Obviously, you know, you can go and post on forums and suggest things, and I sincerely hope that the game lives up to its potential and becomes worthy of the money people have invested on it. But I am uncomfortable with the amount of on how unreliable that process is game to game. You know, I maybe trust in the case of Double Fine, who are a little bit more established as a developer and have pretty clear channels of communication with their community, that they might actually deliver on the promise of listening to what people say in the official forums. But that's not going to be the case of every early access game.
Yeah.
And the whole thing exposes people who are innocently spending money on something that looks nice based on a trailer to a whole suite of, you know, well, I don't want to use a really loaded word, like, sort of being duped, but it does feel like there's a huge risk of that inherent in it. Mm. And that might not be specific to Space Base or any of the games that we talk about, but the whole system seems to put players who are spending money in a tremendously vulnerable position.
I don't think it's good for the developers either. Because, yeah. I mean, you say, and they are, like you say, getting the money for the game up front so they can continue to develop it. And that sounds like a good thing. But if the first impression of this game is overwhelmingly negative for the largest number of players who are actually devoted to spending time in it, then that's going to hurt that developer. Maybe not for this game because they've already taken their money, but for the next one that they release. Like Goddess, for example, is anybody going to kind of believe 22 Cans next venture? Is anybody going to put up money in front, up front for that? I don't think so.
Again, I stress I'm playing devil's advocate with this sort of stuff. But I'm not sure that it is the largest number of players, though. I think this is probably a tiny sliver of their potential audience. And this is the thing we were talking about when we were drinking a couple of nights ago when there wasn't a microphone in front of us, where it's the thing that Valve always encourage people to do is just release a version of your game and keep working on it and keep making it better. And there are a ton of instances like the Stanley Parable that just came out that it doesn't matter that this was a free mod that came out years ago.
But it was free!
That's the point! That's the thing. But I think it's true that it's true also with games that are being sold. Like, the fact that it's got a price tag and it's 20 quid and it's not finished, I think that actually limits the audience and it puts a bunch of people off from buying it. And the largest potential audience for that game is the one that hasn't yet bought it. And they'll see a huge uptick on their sales the second that they hit version 1.0, just in the same way as Minecraft did, despite what a phenomenon Minecraft was in every other way.
Perhaps. But
it doesn't mean that the game shouldn't be condemned if it's shit.
No, it's more that it's just really poor value, and I don't think it's expressed. And the thing is, not all of these games are equal. Some better benefit from being shown in the early stages of development than others. I would say that something like AudioSurf doesn't benefit from this, but maybe games like Prison Architect clearly do, because the promise of that is this massive simulation. You can really, you have like a working toy box already, and you can see how that would be layered with kind of additions which would only increase your enjoyment.
I think that's the thing, though, that like I went and read the Space Base forums just out of interest, see what people are saying, and a lot, you know, even the people who are positive were like, well, I kind of wish there was kind of more to this, and I kind of, you know, I've drained it of my kind of potential investment, and I will, you know, and as with those people, I think I'm in the same boat, that I will wait 6 months and go back and play it again after it's had another couple of dozen updates. But the point is, and I think you're right, that initial experience of discovering something has been kind of taken away. You know, the sense of how much is in something, how much depth and of having a long road ahead of discovery of new systems and stuff, especially in systems different games, is actually really important, rather than simply knowing, okay, I know roughly how deep this is now. You know, and if they add more to that, it'll simply be extending a journey I've already been pretty much all the way down. I really find it unsatisfying, like, as a game proposition, without a meaningful way of contributing to that expansion process myself. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not being asked really in any substantial way to expand upon the game as it currently is. Just kind of try it out and let us know what you think is not enough. And I don't know, I just think the value proposition for people is so poor, and it's not clearly flagged that it's poor. And the people, to be honest, who are going to be encountering this are potentially the most important people. It'll be your first round of Let's Players. It'll be the people who would go on to make your subreddit if you were going to get one, right? It'll be those people in that first wave of early access.
I think that people who buy into early access buy into a saga. They don't buy into the initial experience. They buy into getting excited about each update. and going back to the thing over and over again and watching it grow. I think that's actually the appeal of something like Kerbal Space Program, where they released the 0.22 update recently, and everyone went, oh, holy crap, there's all this kind of, they actually put the campaign in, we could go back to this thing. And actually, it's a source of excitement for them that happens every couple of weeks for the next 6 months until the game, then they get a full game out of it. So for a lot of people who, people who buy games are pretty savvy about what they're getting, and like, they'll consume media about it a lot of the time. And they'll know that this stuff isn't going to be finished, and they're going to know that, you know, they're going to look for regular updates, and they'll get excited about those instead. It's more about buying into episodic.
Maybe there's an element of that.
I think it helps. I'm switching sides now.
Tom's switched into the devil's
advocate.
I think it helps when there is a core loop which is fun, like in and of itself.
And the thing with slice,
And as you say, Prison Architect, there was a game there that you could play, and it had bugs, but it was basically functional, and you could play it and have fun with it, and then you could see how they would layer on complexity. Yeah. Kerbal Space Program worked from the very first alpha because it was a toy box, and you stuck rockets together like Lego bricks, and then it exploded in the air. Yeah. I don't even think, like, the first version of that game, I'm not even sure it was possible to get into orbit. I think you just got up to a certain height and then fell back down to Earth. I'm not sure, maybe I was just bad at it. But certainly there was no greater simulation past that point, but it was just fun in itself as that little toy. And it sounds like you guys talking about space base, that's not the case. But it's fundamentally broken in important ways. And
it's also that you full on, I mean, maybe it's not that dissimilar, maybe it's just a different opinion, but you do full on run out of things to do. Once you have the right selection of rooms in your space station, you can only build more of those rooms to expand as your capacity needs to increase. And so you are essentially repeating the same loop. So there is a core loop there. There is a core loop. You know what I mean? It is, if you want to say that that's the measure of basic completeness, then there is a game there. But it's just not gratifying.
It sounds like it's not balanced well. Like, I mean, like, the thing is, in, say, a game like SimCity, you fundamentally just do the same things over and over again. You expand your city a little bit, and now you need another fire building? What?
Fire station.
Fire station! Fire engine? What? Fire station, hospital, and police place.
I was genuinely kind of just imagining, like, an igloo built out of flames, that you were saying.
It's very,
that's the podcast title, but it's balanced really well. So that anytime you do anything, it unbalances the scale so that you need to build the next thing. Is that kind of driving force in space base? Yeah. Or do you just feel like you can reach a certain size and then you could just stop?
You can kind of stop. One of the things that happens is you get hailed by sort of incoming ships that are like, hey, we'd love to live here. We're lost. And you can say no to a lot of them. And there are variants on that encounter that can go different ways. But you get to a point where your station's kind of ticking on quite nicely and there's nothing to really do other than expand. But you have to choose not to expand. So, you know, it's like, well, we're fine with 7 people. We've got a pub. Everyone's got a place to sleep. We don't need any more matter because we've mined out all the asteroids around us, but there's no reason to do anything. And a derelict's just warped in. But we might die if we go over there. So why not? You know what I mean?
It's not selling you on the promise of what it's going to develop into.
Yeah.
Right, that's the thing.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe it's a very specific thing. I'm kind of against this sort of stuff in general, but maybe it's just because I love that feeling of knowing that there's sort of always something to discover about what's going to happen. I always feel tremendously disappointed when I feel like I've gotten to the bottom of a simulation.
Right.
You know, so SimCity, new one, felt like I got to the bottom of its simulation very, very quickly. That was the game done. Like, I've got no interest in sort of repeating the same loop forever. And I guess that is a kind of journey I can only go on with the game once before I need a pretty big break from it. And I think early access just invites me to have the disappointing version of a game that might be good in a year. I don't know.
Can I segue?
Go for it.
I want to segue into the game that I've been playing this week, which is in fact an early access game. But it's, I think it's one of the ones which benefit from early access because in itself it's a complete loop of gameplay that you can only imagine being expanded in ways which are beneficial to it. Nuclear Throne by Vlambeer, who made Super Crate Box,
and Ridiculous Fishing, and other things,
many many good things.
Gun Gods.
It's fantastic. It's a top-down roguelike shooter. I don't know how extensive the game is because I'm not very good at it, so I haven't got terribly far in it. But what's there is extremely enjoyable to play again and again and again, and there's already kind of a very identifiable array of strategies available to you. So you play, I think they're characters who appear in previous games that you can play as.
Maybe?
I'm not super familiar with Vlambeer's characters.
There's overlapping things in terms of certain weapons that appear in Super Crate Box and that kind of thing.
It used to be called Wasteland Kings, in case somebody's been following the development a bit prior to this, but now it's called Nuclear Throne. You play as one of, I think, six characters. Each of them has very differentiated special abilities, which are usually on the right mouse button, and you kind of aim your primary weapon with the left mouse button. So there's a guy who can kind of throw snares at enemies. There's a dude who has the power pop-pop, which apparently means to fire two shots in rapid succession. There's a guy who can dual-wield, who's my favourite. A guy, he's called Steroids. He's just this kind of walking muscle mass. It's grotesque. somebody who's immune to explosives. But it's surprising how much that really changes, not your initial strategy. And then as you encounter random weapon drops and you're faced with upgrade screens, which allow you to upgrade from a randomly selected number of upgrades, how much your strategy needs to adapt as you go through the course of this game. And it seems at first like it's just this kind of fairly frivolous shmup, kind of like almost bullet hellish. But the more you play it, the more you realize just how subtle the differences between these characters are. So for the reason that the muscle mass guy called Steroids is my favourite is because he can dual wield. You always have two weapons, but you need to switch between them to fire them. But he can fire both simultaneously on left and mouse button. And that makes it great for kind of reacting to situations where you're suddenly faced with a boss monster. And so you want to switch out your kind of rapid firing weak weapon for just something that will splat this thing. So you switch immediately to your heavy weapon. Things like that just make it extreme. And the other thing about it is it feels amazing to play. Like they've just done this, just tremendous job on the kind of feedback from every single shot. And I know that Graham interviewed these guys about this for RPS this week.
Yeah, so I played it on your recommendation, and I suck at it. I didn't get very far. I don't think I've got beyond, like, level 3. There's, like, a random boss encounter that can happen at level 2 or 3 that pretty much kills me every time. But I really like the way the guns feel, but when we talk about this stuff, or at least when I talk about this stuff, I'm really unsatisfied with... Like, there's no...
It is meaty, really, you say.
Yeah, physics are crunchy.
You say it's visceral.
It's got some significant wow, I'd say.
Wow. So I emailed them, basically, and asked, how do they make their games
How do you make
feel?
Wow?
How do you make wow? Mm. Because, like, Vlambeer are really good at this. Like, Super Crate Box, I loved and was really hooked on. And it does the same thing. And even Ridiculous Fishing, which is an iPhone game, has guns that feel really good. Because you grab fish on the way down and then fling them in the air and then tap to fire them when they're in the air to kill them all. And that's how you get points. And he wrote, Jan, who's the lead designer there, wrote a really detailed breakdown of the way in which the pistol works. Basically, the different settings they have for the rate of fire and the screen shake and the way it kind of, the screen kicks back when you fire in the opposite direction from which you fire, but then also has a shake which degrades in less than a second, and the speed at which the clip comes out of your gun, and the way they put a little bit of animation to just move your gun back to pixels so that it looks like your character is reloading manually when they're using a shotgun, so it looks like they're actually pumping it, but they're not. And the sprite on the bullet for the first two frames is a circle, so that it looks like muzzle flash. And that kind of like slight angle that it comes out based on where you're aiming and the way they design enemy sprites and the environment in order to make all this stuff feel good. It's just...
You see, what I was saying last week about having...
I feel physically a bit hot under the...
Like having a floating group of developers to go and advise on the feel of games. I think Vlambeer have got it down pat there. They should just go around telling Ubisoft, no, need more screen shake on this, etc. Needs more wow.
I think, oh man, the bit with the little slightly round pixels.
It is super hot.
Sounds like what I like about it is this combination of mathematically controlling a huge number of variables, but then doing it all by instinct, kind of just tweaking here and there, and just kind of trying it over and over again. So that's the kind of art, the art of it.
It's a total perfect synthesis of science and art.
It's beautiful, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
That was the other thing he said, was that this is one, this is one of the advantages of early access. It's basically that they put it out and they get a ton of player feedback and they see other people playing it, and that half their development time is already spent with just them playing it. Just playing it and then going, oh, we should try this now.
That's not a benefit of early access. That is a benefit of testing your game.
No, like, it's a benefit to developers of early access in that they get a great amount of feedback before they call a thing done. It's not a benefit to players.
Not to return to the earlier discussion, but I do genuinely think that the old form of beta testing, where people assumed that meant in the contract between a player and a developer was fine and didn't need replacing with a commercial thing. That's probably the last thing I'll say.
It is actually, I think it's about $10 to buy now, which is probably on the high end of what I'd pay for that kind of game. What's Spelunky buying? Does anybody know how much that?
That's about seven quid. So it's about the same. More than that. I thought it was like $15, 12 quid, whereas Nuclear Throne is 14 quid, $10. But I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. Sure. Well, yeah, show notes. But the point is, it's quite an expensive value proposition. But it is an extremely enjoyable game to play as it is right at this moment. And I can only see good ways for it to develop. I hope they are looking at Spelunky for a template. I want, as the game progresses, there to be significant divergences in the kind of strategies that you're forced to, like Spelunky, when you decide, okay, I can't do this on this run, but I'm instead going to go and try and get to hell rather than go to the City of Gold. Making those kind of decisions and having the game branch is obviously pretty important for roguelike, and I hope they're thinking about doing that. As it is, a lot of fun. Good enemies too. Good, really clever enemy design. So even though it's just, you know, they're top-down sprites moving and attacking you, they've thought about lots of different ways to differentiate the enemies and make them very tactically interesting to fight. Yeah, good stuff.
Can I segue from games I want to
give me a
take
hot segue?
Spelunky. Well, a few podcasts ago, I talked about Eldritch and how I hoped that it would learn some lessons about Spelunky, specifically about including things to discover like the City of Gold, Hell, etc. So, at the time, I had played, I think, between 45 minutes and an hour of Eldritch, if that. Like, I ducked into it, I bought the beta, ducked in, played around, kind of got a sense of, I like this. So, you know, it came out today on Steam, it's a first-person, sort of adventure roguelike thing. It's set in a kind of Lovecraftian 20s matinee adventure universe. You, dig through Lovecraftian worlds and attempt to find a soul at the end of each one. And return them to this sort of library hub world, but it is a roguelike, etc. You have sort of a weapon in one hand and a power in the other, and you know, in that way it kind of mixes up the challenge of what powers you get access to, cloaking and hypnosis and teleportation, or what weapons. And what I didn't realize when I first played it, because I didn't really push very far in it, because I actually deliberately didn't want to push too far in it, I wanted to wait for it to be finished and so I could kind of have that sense of discovery and of drilling down through something substantial. It came out today. I got the Steam version. And I beat it all on my first go.
Ah.
Which I've never done with a roguelike before. Like, I've never finished Spelunky.
Were you lucky?
No.
Oh.
But careful. and this is what's interesting about Eldritch, is it's really easy. As long as you are careful. And there are sort of like top level designy reasons for that. I think, platforming is a kind of way of traversing an environment that is possible to fail dramatically immediately without you really knowing that you're failing it. Like yesterday, doing a Spelunky daily, I just walked off a ledge slightly too fast, and rather than dropping down to the safe tile immediately in front of me, I went two tiles over into some spikes, and I'm dead, and my run is over, right? Like, everyone has done that, and that's just a basic platforming fail. In FTL, everything is sort of tile, you know, encounter based. It's encounter after encounter after encounter, and it is fully possible to warp into an encounter that screws you, right? And that's your run over. Because Eldritch is a first person, an FPS, really, you can be very careful and discreet in every move you make and everything you choose to do in order to explore. And that's the kind of the first reason why it's actually pretty hard to fall afoul of any of its traps. But later on, you'll encounter tripwires that shoot you if you trip them. But they're really visible, so you just don't. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of instances where its challenges are like, well, I just won't do that. And that's compounded by a system of kind of upgrades and equipment you can find, that ultimately make it really straightforward. So, I'm going to come on to some positive stuff after this, actually, but this needs setting up first. So by the end of my run, I had stealth boots, which meant that, whenever I moved, I'd make any noise whatsoever. And all your attacks do more if enemies aren't aware of you. Enemies like cultists and later on, like, old one-style Cthulhu monsters and stuff. They're all adorable. It's really sweet. It's all done in foxholes. It looks a bit like Minecraft. And so I got a dagger that I had from very early on and just dash at people and knife them straight away, silently. I also had a rune thing that empowered all of my attacks with weapons, but also gave my revolver the power to shoot out blocks in the environment. And because almost every level until you get towards the end involves drilling down from the top of the level to the bottom, usually winding your way around whatever route the random level generation has given to you, down all through these catacombs, finding those ways down is part of the challenge. As soon as you can shoot through the ground, you can make your own path. And if you're not sure how to get to the other side of a wall or a locked door, if you don't want to waste a key to get through a locked door, you make a hole. You just do it yourself. And I had so many bullets and so much currency and so much of everything that there was no challenge. There's no question of conserving resources. Like, if it got me through the challenge, just drill. And there is a satisfaction to solving a puzzle in that way, like actually making your own solution. But it's not sufficient to stop me from completing the game in the first go. And the final thing was a med kit item that meant that whenever I died, I had the option to spend a certain amount of currency to just come back to life exactly where I died.
Sounds like you were pretty lucky with the kind of drops you had.
There isn't a sufficient variety of items in the game, and there is a plentitude of shops that means that you can reliably encounter all of this stuff. I saw, for example, I had a cloaking spell as well, made me invisible for about 10-20 seconds, which meant that whenever I got in trouble, I became invisible in that way. And I came across the shrine that gives you that specific spell 3 or 4 times in the 2 hours it took me to finish. So I felt comfortable knowing that I could have gotten it, right? Just from a critical point of view. Okay, and then, and on the way through it though, there were things that really stood out to me and that I think are genuinely awesome. The second zone in particular has great monster design. Like some of the way it kind of varies, the kind of things you face is really cool. And discovering what monsters do is really satisfying. And to the extent that I don't want to mechanically spoil a lot of stuff that's really interesting to discover. And there's stuff that in a more punishing roguelike, where I didn't have multiple get-out-of-jail-free cards on me at any time, would have been kind of that kind of, oh man, that killed me, but I learned something. The Spelunky thing, right? The, oh, I've just learned what the blocks in the temple do moment. Right?
Yeah, I remember swearing in that.
Yeah. Whereas with this, it was like, oh shit! Okay, I fixed it. It's like, and that got me almost to the end of the game. But when you get to the end of the game, you unlock New Game Plus, which essentially, when you start again, it adds a little collectible right in front of you when you spawn in the library that is the hub world thing. And if you pick that up, it kind of indicates that you want to be in New Game Plus mode, which makes a million different changes to make it harder. Traps are more numerous, there's less resources are less scarce, weapons are far, far rarer, enemies are faster and more numerous, tougher enemies from later in the game spawn in earlier worlds, all this stuff. And the game is actually great.
Wow.
Like, it goes from... that is the game that they should have released as it was.
Oh,
like,
so hang on. So do you think that having the easy version up front spoils it? Or
yes.
Do you...
So this is what I was going to go on to right, say. Okay. That, like, I'm now really excited to play this game. Like, I completed it in essentially one sitting and thought, oh, that was fun. And I did enjoy it. Like, it's you know, there's lots of strengths to a presentation that I haven't gone into, etc. But, and lots of lovely movement and great little bits of design. But I was like, I'm kind of done with this. Like, it was just too simple and it's over now. But I've now played like a million, like, individual really short attempts at the very first world that I just wandered through casually the first time I played it. And I'm really struggling. And you get like Shoggoths, which are terrifying, spawning in the very first part of the game and chasing you through corridors and stuff. And even surviving those first couple of levels is now really, really hard.
Hmm.
And there's a tremendous sense of reward when you then crack it, and finding a revolver is now a big deal. Whereas by default, when you first play the game, you'll find revolvers in like piles of 4 or 5. literally, you know what I mean? It is that different. And the biggest problem I have is that I'm now interested in approaching it from a mechanical point of view. And there's an option, I think, a different way of finishing it that I want to try and find and do. So there's some stuff to discover, and I'm excited to play it like that. And I may even do some YouTube stuff because I'm interested in playing it like that. But it's a shame that I have seen all of the game's environments and monsters, as far as I can tell, before I got to that point. You know what I mean? I just feel like something's been lost in terms of getting that, you know, It's, I mean, you said in the previous podcast, Graham, that the first time you realised that there's a jungle in Spelunky, right, is this kind of like, holy shit, there's a thing beyond this, right? And I can't really get that with Eldritch now, right? Like, I'm going to be delighted the first time I crack the first world on this harder setting. But the thing that lies beyond that and the kind of monsters I'll encounter there is not a secret to me because I've already been through it once. So it feels like a kind of tremendous shame. And I think, I wonder how much of your, like you're saying, Wasteland Kings, you both said that you suck at it. But how much of your...
That's great. It's great. No, exactly. It's great that it's really hard.
But it's great. Like, and that is buoyed up your interest in replaying it.
But I wonder if there is, is there an audience that roguelikes usually miss, which are people who just want to play through a game the first time? And do you think that maybe this is a better compromise?
I feel like it should have been an option.
Right.
You know, like, it almost feels like the game as it currently exists would be a fun little... I mean, the game is like £8, right? Like, I'm ultimately not going to give it a tremendous shooing critically for being something you can run through in 2.5 hours the first time without too much fuss. But, like, it feels like you could play it in FPS mode, where you get a fun little FPS that feels like a kind of randomly generated adventure game that throws back to, like, old-style FPS design, where it's all about exploration and environmental awareness and kind of being able to map out a level in your head. And then the roguelike version, which is kind of super punishing. And if those two options have been presented to me at the beginning, like, do you want to play this like Duke Nukem 3D or do you want to play it like Rogue? And I'd chosen Rogue, then I would have accepted that. But it's the suddenly, like, I mean, literally, I'm reviewing it. Like, I finished it and went, okay, you know, I liked it, but it's just such a shame it's so easy. And then I thought, well, I'll give this new version a go. And now I'm really into it again. And it feels, it's not too little too late, ultimately, because minimal harm has really been done. But it does, I think, mean that, like, lowering the bar too much, not really challenging people, risks kind of throwing the pace of the entire experience off. And what should be a discovery stops being a discovery because, you know, there's no meaning in having discovered this monster on this level now or whatever.
Maybe you're just amazing at it.
I check the Steam... again, my thing of always reading forums after I've played a game to ratify my flimsily held opinions. That's the common thing. People are saying, like, oh, okay, this is really easy. And it's a shame because I think I'll dominate the conversation about it. And now I've just dominated the conversation with it. But, like, cause there's so many things it does really, 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 really well, and it deserves to do well, I think. Especially because it had this sort of early release beta and then just came out on Steam. It's not an early access game. It's just out.
Speaking of games that could be...
Best segue.
No, I was going to say, speaking of games that you can complete fairly quickly, I completed an indie game with another terrible name. I feel like at some point we should just record like a PSA for...
Eldritch is a pretty good name for a game.
Yeah. Eldritch is a pretty good name. This game is called 140 or 140 or 140.
That's one of the rarest numbers, actually, so that's pretty easy to find on Google. That's fortunate.
Is it about Twitter?
It's a side-scrolling platformer starring a geometric shape, like Thomas was alone. And you start off as a square, but when you move, you turn into a circle, and when you leap, you turn into a triangle. And that's just basically the way in which it animates those three different actions. And so I partly wonder if the name 140 is just because you can make those numbers out of big chunky squares, triangles, and circles. I wonder if that's the reason. But it's by Jep Carlson, who was the lead designer on Limbo, which is written across Martin's chest right now. He's not wearing any clothes, it's just a marker pen.
always, he's always like this.
And he bought this in his spare time, and it won the Excellence in Audio Award at the IGF last year. Because it's a side-scrolling platformer where the world is timed to coincide with the electronic dance music that's playing over the top of it. So when platforms move from side to side or phase in and out of existence, they're doing so to a beat. And that means that you can quite quickly learn the timing of the jumping puzzles that you're doing because you can listen to the music and instinctively, if you've got rhythm, know
the beat of what's happening. And so there are, like, the most basic example is you have to jump to a platform, but you have to, that platform is phasing in and out of existence, and you have to jump to it before it exists, like just before it appears. You have to be already in the air, and that timing puzzle becomes much more easy when its appearance is timed to the beat of the music.
Are you waiting for the drop, essentially, to jump to the next platform?
Well, it's got these kind of like, you kind of levels are structured around finding these kind of floating orbs in the air, which kind of have their own, each one has its own kind of movement pattern or routine, or runs away from you or something like that. And you capture those and drag them to like a pit in the ground that you, like, the little ball drops down into the pit and fills a circle in the ground, at which point the drop happens, so to speak, and like you float into the air and the world's colours morph and change, and the beat gets like a new layer on top of it, and the background of the levels past that point in each level is like a music equalizer, so it's like all these colourful bars and stuff like that, and it looks amazing.
Can't wait to drink a lot.
I was going to say, this sounds a lot like my Saturday night.
it's the kind of
more
game.
Legal than your Saturday night, Chris, I believe.
Thank you.
I don't have much more to say about it than that. It's the kind of game, I completed it in an hour. It's £4 on Steam, or £3.29 at the moment, because it just came out last week. But it had me dancing around in my chair and tapping my foot to it, and it was quite straightforward. And then when you complete it, also like Eldritch, you can play it back again. Only this time all the levels are reversed, so you're traveling from right to left rather than left to right, and there are no checkpoints. So if you die, you go all the way back to the beginning and start again.
I was hoping you'd say something like, it turns into a waltz. Yes, four, yeah. Like 3-4. You know.
That would be amazing.
No, but the hardest, of course, is like contemporary jazz. Who the fuck knows when the platforms are going to appear? The syncopated is crazy.
That would be great.
Yeah, fuck jazz.
But it's just...
wow.
But it's just a nice little thing. And
that's good. That's not on early access.
No, it's just full game. Out. And no one seems to have really noticed that it's out. Like, it won an IGF award, but no one's really talked about the fact that it came out on October 16th.
Yeah, possibly because it's called 140.
Yeah, which makes it just impossible to search for or find.
God damn it, people.
Indie games with rubbish names.
But that is actually maybe a podcast segment.
Please
send me a number.
Tom, what have you been playing?
I've been playing Democracy 3.
Ooh!
Which is great. Simulation of puts you in charge of a democracy of your choosing, and you get to twiddle the knobs until it falls apart, and
you shut down the government for a couple of weeks for no reason.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. That would never happen in reality.
Been really enjoying it. I think it does a better job of communicating what politics is than the entire political establishment does itself. It does a better job of communicating the fact that a society is a web of incredibly complex interreliant systems. And it kind of transcends, look, if you're just kind of skirting on the surface and don't really, you know, you just ignore politics, then, you know, politics, the big problem that politicians have is that you can only deliver simple ideas to the general public. If you're messaging, you know, if you're talking to the general public, it has to be the most reductive, simple statement, otherwise it will just get lost in the chaos of like the media and everything. What Democracy 3 is about is it says that everything is really fucking complicated. Because you can click on a social issue in democracy and it will show you all of the other factors in your society that are contributing positively or negatively to that issue. And it displays democracy as a kind of map of nodes, interlinked by lines. And if you hover the mouse over a node, say unemployment, it will show you all of the contributing factors to the unemployment levels in your society. And I've never seen such a beautiful depiction of the complexity of that issue. Mm. And when you hear it talked about, you know, in the press, or the way politicians talk about it, where it's discussed on current affairs programs, it's always about a couple of reductive ideas that are fighting each other. It's this side versus this side. And it never tunnels down to the fact that there are 100 immeasurable factors involved in unemployment, and actually manipulating that as a system and trying to engineer it is incredibly satisfying. Hmm. So what he's done is he's just built a giant mathematical system where you can poke one end and see ripples go through the entire thing. And I love how easy it is to just break society. So I clicked on what's it called? The global the figure for how rich your country is.
GDP.
GDP, okay. So that's a terrible low. So you click on that and it says, okay, well, the biggest problem here, is productivity of your systems. So that's terrible. So I go click on productivity and say, okay, what's drawing the, dragging that down? And it's alcohol. Everyone's getting drunk. Yeah. So I click on alcohol and see why people are getting drunk. And it helpfully informs me that the reason people are getting drunk is because they're consuming alcohol. So then I have, then I, okay, so, I think, okay, what can I do about this? I can put alcohol, tax on alcohol up. I can make it more expensive. So I bring the alcohol tax up to 50%. Then I can kind of, you can ban types of alcohol and sell only light beers. And you can kind of, you can ban like,
sounds like a terrible, terrible strategy.
You're a monster.
This is the trouble. I became a monster. This is kind of the other interesting thing about playing it, because it was amazing, like, how my ideals wilted in the face of just necessity, just needing to wrangle all these systems into a shape that, you know, a healthy shape to make people like me, meant I just abandoned all my principles. Straight away, I'm generally, like, centrist, like, left-leaning, and that was all right. I put loads of money into the intelligence services, and I put loads of money into stuff that, you know, anti-crime stuff. I obliterated crime. I got rid of crime in my society. Wow. I basically created a police state. because that was easier. It was easier that way, because it let me fiddle with other things more efficiently.
Oh my god.
So this is how it starts.
This is not democracy.
I know, yeah.
They were playing a different game.
Oh, it's so much fun. Like,
there are limiting, like, it has mechanics in there though to limit your stuff. So like, you have to maintain support from your cabinet, and the number of people in your cabinet who support you is dictated by how many of the public support you. And that in turn dictates how many kind of action points you get each turn in order to enact your will and pass policies and that kind of thing. So it does make some effort to limit your megalomaniacal tendencies, Tom.
It's good because, you can also just fire your cabinet at any point and appoint people you like, which is very accurate, I'd say. It's like, okay, you know, that person isn't really doing, like, every cabinet minister will have, a couple of sections of society they'd appeal to. So capitalists might like this one. So you have him in there because it keeps them happy. They know they've got some of their interests in the cabinet. And it feels really accurate to me. Like, the way you would construct a cabinet would be to appeal to the big number of voters. And, their competence is a secondary consideration. It's more about their appeal and how, you know, what I found myself doing was doing these terrible things to try and get GDP back up. And then everyone would dislike me. So I'd throw out a kind of token policy, like a populist token policy that would just make people like me, like free cakes for fucking everyone, wasn't it? this kind of shit, or, you know, food stamps, like people fucking love food stamps in that game. okay, I've created a police state, but you'll have free food now, you know, and kind of doing this trade-off with the public, this give and take.
It wouldn't be chorizo, Martin, don't.
And I think I think it has, great educational benefit as, just a way of showing a society as a complex set of
an exploitable organism.
Yeah, exactly. But something complicated, something that's not straightforward. It's not about, you know, that immunizes people to the rhetoric that often surrounds big issues. Yeah. You know,
I think it's like, it's significant that it doesn't have any kind of media presence in the game. Like, you can like the population makes judgments based on your actions exactly as your actions are, not as the media reports on them. The game has no concept of spin, basically.
Huh. There is an action that can come up which says a newspaper has launched a campaign against you. So if they can rail against you, but the dent it makes to your popularity is utterly minimal. Like, it doesn't, like, unlike media, I suspect, just entirely informs the political opinions of a great number of people in this country, for example. Because these issues are so complex, if you're just interacting with them on a very brief level, you just go with the received wisdom, first of all, because you don't have time to vary into it and actually challenge every assertion that every politician makes or every policy that they talk about. So it kind of feels like, I like this vision of a society of completely rational people. Because it means I can placate them with bullshit more easily, almost, than they're more controllable than they would be if there was actually a media component.
Is it horrendously complicated to actually interface with this thing?
No, it's beautiful. It really is. Like, whenever you click on an issue, it will show you all the factors that contribute to it, positively or negatively, and the extent to which they do in just a list. And you can click on any one of those and move sliders up and down to move tax rates and that kind of thing. And most of the things I wanted to do, there was a slide for it that was easy to get to, and I knew where to go get it. And there's some brilliant kind of report screens, like the intelligence briefing screen is great because it lists all of the kind of groups in your country and their threat level. So they're like, the Wildlife Agency is quite high threat level for me at the moment. I don't know what I've done precisely to piss them off. I may have cut all their funding in order to fund some of the mad scheme, but they hate me. You get each turn is 3 months, and it'll give you a report at the end of each 3 month section, and it'll say, oh, well, the Wildlife Trust has been on the radio bad-mouthing you. And as I haven't found, like, I kind of want to assassinate them. Well, I'm hoping that, like, there's going to be loads of mods for this game, so I'm hoping there's going to be some entertaining.
In prior games, two things. So first of all is that it looks really complicated in screenshots, like that kind of main menu where it's just, like, 60 icons. And whenever you mouse over any of them, you get a kind of neural net type thing where it shows you all the things that negatively or positively impact that. And in screenshots, it looks really intimidating. But actually, you use it, and within about 3 seconds, it's just, oh, I understand this. It's just like a perfect way to illustrate the connections between a bunch of abstract concepts. Like, it just works fine.
Spectacular bit of design. That menu screen, I think.
And it's pretty much the same menu screen as from Democracy 1, even. Mm. But the thing in Democracy 2, which I played dozens of hours of, I've only played a couple of hours of Democracy 3 so far. Democracy 2 was really easy to get assassinated.
Really?
Like, almost every game I ever played of that would just end in assassination, no matter how benign I was trying to be. But like
that's probably true as well.
You felt like, there were like loopholes that pretty quickly you would find in the simulation in terms of being able to enact a police state in your first term, wipe out all crime, piss off a certain group towards you, but then cancel a bunch of those policies in a way that would, like, crime wouldn't come back immediately, but those people would now like you. But I was once assassinated by the Green Party. And the way it works is in that game was they would just bomb Parliament. They would bomb Parliament, killing a huge number of ministers, yourself included, thus ending your term. But there was never any way of that game for you to assassinate them.
No, it
is. Which is very unfair and unrealistic.
Yeah, I think so as well.
Drone strikes, that's what it means. Shall we do questions from questions?
All in favour say aye.
Aye.
Democracy in action.
There he is.
Joshua Walsh says, hello, Creighton crew. I realised there was a problem when I was filling out my CV. I had a template and one of the areas on it was hobbies. I considered gaming to be one of my hobbies, but I was hesitant to put it down. This is because I don't want my potential employer thinking I'm some sort of no-life who wastes his time playing video games in the basement. We all know this assumption's wrong, is it? Is it?
I don't live in the basement.
But do you think that society's opinion on video games is something that needs to be tackled? Also, have you ever withheld the information that you play video games for fear of it degrading your standing? P.S. I was one of the people that thought Tom Sr. was the senior Tom. yes. Yeah, I do avoid telling people that I'm professionally involved in gaming.
I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, or maybe previously on the PC Gamer podcast, but like when I was a kid, I was desperately ashamed of being playing games all the way through my teenage years. Like, I'd never confess to it and maintained a kind of completely separate life socially apart from people who played games. And it's getting into this job that kind of, it's been the first time in my life that I've had friends that also play video games. That's what we talk about in the pub. But I would say that nowadays, because there's a cliche about game journalists that people don't actually say what they do for a living or lying about what it is you actually do. And the cliche is usually surrounded by the concept of meeting someone that you're attracted to in a bar.
Yes, I'm a writer.
Yeah, I'm a writer. I work in media. I'm a journalist.
What do you write about? Technology.
Yeah. Oh, man, the old technology line. Yeah, and I've been there, and that's led...
The future of art.
All right, edge writer. But that, for me, has ended now in a kind of defiant honesty, to the extent that I explain that I'm a games journalist with a tone of defiance that I think is possibly alarming to people who either think that's cool or think it's fine, or
I play games, so fuck you.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much like, I'm a fucking games journalist, alright? And then I cry and run away.
You grab your necklace. This is a Dota 2 symbol. Yeah. Do you know what Dota 2 is?
Yeah, no, actually, really, but like, so yeah, this fucking necklace. But like, the idea behind it was that, like, you know, and I've explained this casually before, but the idea behind it was that, like, I think it's a fairly neutral looking symbol, but if someone recognizes it, I'm probably going to be friends with that person because they recognize that it's Dota and whatever, have something in common. And so nowadays, again, the same defiant honesty. People are like, oh, so what's that? And now the answer is like, it's a fucking video game. If you recognize this, we can be friends. And then I cry and run away.
Yeah, I think Trip Hawkins did an interview with him was published today in which he stated that given 50 years, everybody who doesn't play games will be dead. which is probably, I mean, it's true. More or less true, really. Yeah. I mean, it's massive. The gaming has been massively destigmatized in simply the last 7 years that I've been working in the games industry. And just the number of women who are now playing it is rising in direct proportion to that. I think that's indicative of how much it's become accepted as a pastime.
It's also, I mean, it's Facebook and to a lesser extent, the Wii. And we can be scornful of Facebook games because they're not very good a lot of the time. Mm. But they have done as a good service in terms of just getting a bunch of people who wouldn't normally be playing games and kind of normalizing that behavior for them in a way that makes the kind of culture around it less weird and alien and distant.
I also detect a certain defensiveness around games that kind of make it into the mainstream sphere, things like GTA and Call of Duty.
Bioshock's about objectivism. It's about politics and Ayn Rand and stuff, yeah? It's dead smart.
This is desperation for...
Shitting people shut in up the me face.
From the past.
Litting the bins.
Desperation for the things that penetrate, like that appeal to the zeitgeist to be representative of the best in gaming. And it's the thing that the things that are most popular in game that will appeal to the mainstream will never be those things. It will always be about blowing things up and shooting people for now.
No, it's like The Wire. It's like, you know, it's like The Godfather.
It's satire. It's the best satire ever.
Best satire ever.
It's ever.
It's meta.
Yeah, it's this kind of defensiveness.
But that defensiveness will die alongside the people who... I mean, the reason that people...
the long list of people who will die. Continued.
But the reason that people are defensive about that is because games are judged by people who are game naive on the same basis that they judge other forms of art. Mm. And as soon as those people turn to dust and their memories fade from this earth, the sooner the better.
I mean, that
those criteria will become less important for judging games, and people will be able to say, hey, this is a great shooter, because it's a great shooter, and it doesn't necessarily need to have things that aren't about the mechanics layered on top of it to justify its qualities.
I just finished watching every single episode of CSI Miami last night. All 235 episodes are not never fucking let it be ashamed.
We don't know how to waste our time.
Yeah.
It's okay that it's junk.
I think this is actually, what I was going to say is that the concern, the sort of gesture around that like games aren't high art or high culture yet, I maybe in their current form struggle to aspire to be, is kind of fine, because I think popular forms of entertainment will always only really replace popular forms of entertainment. Playing video games will be the new soap operas for a generation of people who don't relate to Coronation Street or EastEnders, but play video games every night. And, you know, high cultural chunter on as it ever has been, maintaining its existence through, you know, the systems of exclusivity and certain kinds of education and access to art that limit those kinds of things anyway. And people will be completely used to just playing games on after work by the time, Marsh, we are dead.
That'll never happen. That'll never.
Brain in a jar. That'll be.
Yeah. Angry brain in a jar.
Angry brain in a jar, running a country, putting alcohol tax up to 50%. fuck them all. They didn't like video games and
I don't have a mouth, I can't drink. Why should these plebs be able to?
Precisely.
I hate you, senior brain.
I like being. Yeah, I want to be the senior brain.
Would you have a spider body? Or would you just
if
be.
If I could. Snake body, I think.
Snake body.
Yeah. Well, that diverged.
Yeah. Hot tangent, boys.
Sir Jolt describes a terrible misunderstanding. He says, "Hi, Crates. During last week's episode, one of you mentioned that you had a Splunky run, which began with a text. I grabbed my whip and thought of her for the last time."
Sorry, I just remembered how funny that sounds.
"Somehow, I heard this as, I grabbed my whip and thought of Earth for the last time. I immediately paused and toddled off to rethink Splunky in this new extraterrestrial context. This reminded me of another time that completely misunderstanding something changed my experience of a game. So he talks about Oblivion for a bit and says that he had been on a 12-hour shift when it first came out, so he was in some kind of horrible fugue state. So he starts in Anvil, which is one of the early towns, and he says, I had no idea there was a fast travel option, since there hadn't been one in Morrowind that I can remember. Having read some coverage of Oblivion that critiqued it for feeling less open than its predecessors, I assumed that the entire game was set in this small town. Every tiny detail seemed significant. I fought for the friendship of every resident, thinking I would have to make love... Sorry. Okay, I might read that bit again. Okay. I fought for the friendship of every resident, thinking...
He's not getting kept in now.
Thinking I would have to make them all love me, so that I could perhaps marry their widowed countess.
I'll marry your widowed countess then.
I played the Elder Scrolls IV Heroes of Anvil for about 20 hours, marvelling at the bravery of their decisions, and sometimes confused by odd design decisions. Eventually, someone asked me to carry a letter to another town, and I wandered out onto the road. The feeling of raw joy when I arrived to find another town as richly detailed as my beloved Anvil is impossible for me to communicate in an already rambling email. P.S. You cannot imagine my heartbreak when, having installed the DLC for Oblivion, I opened the game to find a terrible darkness had overcome Anvil. I imagine no one felt that loss so keenly. Which is a great story. Ben Rose asks, why are so many games journalists either Scottish or called Tom? It's a good point, actually, but it's weirder than you think.
Yeah.
Because not only are so many games journalists Scottish, they all come from the same fucking town.
Yeah, like the amount of weird little connections in this industry is bizarre.
Yeah, I think like Chris and I could run through a few different connections. But so I grew up about 20 miles away from Craig Pearson, who used to work at PC Gamer and is now a freelancer. I also went to the same primary school as Richard Stanton, who used to work for Edge and is now a freelancer for Eurogamer and The Guardian and a bunch of different places. He was like a year above me, I think, but we did go to the same primary school at the same time before he moved down south. And Chris, I know you've got a bunch of weird coincidences with other games journalists.
I went to the same primary school in Liverpool as Dave Valjalo, who subsequently worked for Edge and is now a freelancer. I discovered last year that I am distantly related to Dan Grigliopoulos.
No way, really?
Who...
See, he used to go out with my sister.
Who used to go out with my sister?
Like, before you were a game journalist?
Because me and Dan both have, like, my mum's Welsh, and I think there's a side of Dan's family that's Welsh rather than Greek, as his surname suggests. And we can both trace our kind of matrilineal lineage to Prestatyn in North Wales and the same family. As far as I can tell, there were a series of very localized spillages sometime in the 80s, and late 70s that just created British games generally.
We're saying it's genetic. That it's some kind of horrible disease, basically.
I am programmed by a youth reading comics to assume that this is some kind of spillage, Martin. and I'm a spillage, I will assume.
I think it's cultural. I think it's people who were born in places where you don't want to go outside that much.
Speaking of which,
I was in Scotland.
I came from Birmingham, and that's the end of the story. That's how all stories about Birmingham end.
You don't really have any explanation for the Tom thing.
That's just a freakish
question. I mean, I guess that's maybe localised to PC Gamer the way we had at one point. Mm. 3 to 4 Toms
that was
working for us
really
simultaneously.
Strange. We've got 2 Tom S's working for us at the moment. It's me and Tom Sykes who does new stuff. It's really odd.
Yeah, I mean...
That makes no fucking sense. That's magic, obviously.
Maybe it's just the popularity of certain names in the 80s, I guess, might be the...
Yeah, I guess Tom is the most popular, I think.
Yeah.
There it is.
Whole lot of Thomas.
And you are the most senior of all of them.
Oh, yes. Too senior for my shirt.
Alec Parkin.
So senior. It hurts.
Alec Parkin writes... Oh, good lord.
He's gone.
Didn't you grow up near Owen as well? Or
my family comes from the same village.
There we go.
See,
okay.
Series of localized villages. Yeah. This is what I'm saying. It's like, or like maybe atomic tests. I don't know.
Alec Parkin writes, "Dear Created Croatians, just had my first game, Astralis, published on Xbox Live Indie Games, an over-the-shoulder shooter. So my question to you, fine gents, is... what aspects or gameplay would you like modern shooters to bring back from old-school shooters, such as Doom, Quake, Duke Nukem, Unreal, etc.?"
Jump pads.
Jump pads. Oh, that is, yes, that is a good one.
Quake solid 3. Jump pads.
Great. Yeah. I think I've said this on previous podcasts, but I want the whole pickups thing to come back, which is kind of diminished, really.
Yeah.
But I like that. I like that as a way of generating flow around levels. I think that makes it interesting.
Score screens at the end that tell you how many secret levels you missed, or secret areas you missed, sorry.
Mm. Is it Doom here?
Yeah, well, Doom, you can kind of build in the same thing. Like, that sort of, oh man, I have to replay that now feeling, rather than just, I've finished the corridor.
It's amazing, actually, playing, because I played Duke Nukem again for a reinstall in PC Gamer, and how secret those secrets are. They're pretty fucking secret. Like,
top secret.
You don't know about them. That's because they're secret. Whereas, like, a secret in a today's game is, like, you walked into a room.
That's
it wasn't the room that leads to the next cutscene. It was just a room, but it was right next to you. And there's a thing there, and it says, secret found! You think, well, try really that hard to conceal it. Whereas Duke Nukem, you really need to do elaborate shit in order to find its secrets.
Hmm. This is an age of cheat helplines, in which games companies used to make money from people phoning up for cheats and that kind of thing. And also magazines like, I remember the old Games Masters running cheat guides, and that was a big deal.
Tips were a big thing for games magazines back in the day. That was like 40% of a games journalist's job was writing tips.
Codes that you had.
Martin Donald writes, "Hello again, Creighton cronies. I'm super excited for the Oculus Rift. And I'm sure you guys are too. What I'd like to ask is which games, or specific moments in games, are you looking forward to experiencing again with the Rift strapped to your face? For the purposes of this question, let's go ahead and assume every 3D game ever has had Rift support hacked into it. High up on my Rift-defying list is sticking my head through a portal in Portal, watching myself being Strogified in Quake 4, and falling to my death in Mirror's Edge."
I actually have fallen to my death in Mirror's Edge wearing an Oculus Rift.
Oh, yes.
I was in this very room when I did it.
Yeah, that was pretty shoddy Oculus Rift support. Hopefully, it would
feel better. I guess the first point would be that Mirror's Edge's Rift support as it currently stands is not great. But actually, I was surprised at how not particularly, I was going to say visceral, my response was, actually. It was sort of... I think I remember saying this out loud at the time, but I sort of like fell off a skyscraper to my death and went sort of like, oh dear. And it was sort of like, oh, I sort of wish that hadn't happened. I mean, you did this rush and the kind of lurch in your stomach, but it wasn't quite the kind of, you know, it wasn't like, you know, you die in the Matrix, you die in real life, which is, I think, probably the other extreme.
That was the experience you were looking for.
Yeah, yeah, like some form of kind of like, you know, dead in one life, not in the other. Brain body disconnect did not happen. I'll say that much.
I look forward to blinking in Dishonored, the feeling of rushing forward into a different space.
We tried Dishonored, didn't we, actually, as well? Did that?
We did, but it wasn't, we didn't get very far with it.
Yeah, it's not probably calibrated, but I mean, yeah, no, that would be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, just being zoomed into a slightly different 3D space.
I just want to try all the games with cockpits in it, and I know that's the kind of obvious thing that the Oculus Rift is good for, but that's the obvious thing the Oculus Rift is good for.
Real good for cockpits.
And the Euro Truck Simulator guys just released the beta of Euro Truck Simulator 2 with Oculus Rift support. Right. So, in fact, right before I came here, I drove from Cardiff to Southampton wearing the Oculus Rift.
Awesome.
And it's really cool. Like, just turning around and, you know, like, there's a bed in my lorry. I can sleep there later. And when you turn around to look at the window, you automatically kind of lean out through the window.
Oh, yeah.
At which point, like, the window doesn't roll down. Your head just kind of clips through it. But you hear the sound from outside. And that's actually really useful for when you're, like, reversing into parking spaces, which is the most complicated maneuver you can do in Euro Truck Simulator 2 is reversing without jackknifing or whatever it's called, your truck and stuff like that. So being able to kind of look out the window behind yourself as you do it is a kind of
hard,
immersive thing that you don't normally get.
Can you stick your head out the window and then kind of loll your tongue out so it flaps behind you?
I'd probably just feel the foam of the giant Oculus Rift that's covering my face when I do it. It'd be a little bit gross.
But I tried the Oculus Rift the first time over the weekend, like probably getting to grips with it and playing Half-Life, and I did have to stop playing after about 45 minutes because it's just too smeary at the moment. Like, turning your head quickly is, like, really disoriented.
It's a low refresh rate and a low resolution thing still. So
this is the enjoyable thing about Half-Life 2 on the Oculus Rift is that it plays more like a laser gun game, because there's a central circle in the screen with which you can freely move your mouse cursor to target your gun, and then you move by kind of scraping, you move your vision by scraping to the sides of the screen, which kind of made it feel like I quite enjoyed getting precision headshots with that kind of system.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we had a very similar discussion about it
before
when me and Mark played it for, like, played through most of it, and that feeling of your gun being independent of your body, which is the light really gun thing, is really, really good.
Really like that.
Yeah. Joe M describes a tale of woe. He says, hey guys, a gaming experience tonight has left me in dire need of some sympathetic ears. And it's quite a long email, so I'm going to massively, massively abridge it. I'm sorry, Joe. But he describes getting interest in playing PlanetSide 2, then committing to the 9GB download from Steam. I'm just going to read out the things that he encountered, which were problems for him getting into the game. So as soon as he hits the Play Steam button, downloading DirectX, then he gets into the game, creates an account. Then a bit further on, there's been an unexpected error. An account cannot be created this time. And then later, error, you cannot sign up as your location is UK. Please use Europe Weblink. Then your username and or password has not been recognised. Contact support for help. And then later, still, checking files, downloading 23 megabytes of 2,396 megabytes, 0.1% done. At which point he says, fuck this shit. yes. So, sorry about that, Joe M. What game has made you think, fuck this shit, and why, is his question. But really, I just want to read that out as a kind of sign of solidarity. There are a lot of games now in this auto-updating age, which the initial download does not necessarily indicate the final step to your being able to play the game.
Mm.
I find that very frustrating, specifically as somebody with really bad internet access at my house. Like, when something auto-updates in the background, I basically just can't use my internet connection for that duration. So I turn off auto-updates. So whenever I want to play a game, there's now, like, half an hour, maybe a day delay before I can play it. And that's a frustration to me. I don't know how you can get around that, really.
PC gaming in general is fucking bullshit. And I think...
that's what we're done here.
peace out.
Yeah, peace out.
No, but like,
it's got a lot better.
It's got a lot better, but I still have occasional problems of just that kind of endless thing of... updating and creating accounts and errors what's my origin password again? And these things just drag on. And I mean, Games for Windows Live is in its death throes at the moment, but it was particularly bad for it. And it, in its last moments, is still making people go to great lengths to save the Batman saves.
Capcom have said, we have no idea what will happen when Games for Windows Live disappears. We just don't know. We just don't know how we're drawing the service.
You know, in order to hasten the death of Windows Live, I would kill all my save games. All of the save games that I have, not even associated with Games for Windows Live, I just sacrifice them on a big pyre in order to make it die quicker.
That's worth it.
There's a GIF in these situations which I like, which we'll link in the show notes.
Oh yeah.
But it's just it's Gary's mod, and it's a character in CS Office, the Counter Strike map, and just doing like a flappy arm movement to destroy one of the computers in the desk on the desks, and then it cuts to a black screen which just says fucking PC gaming. it's very cathartic. And in moments like that, I wish that I wrote about 3DS games for a living.
Yeah, I think there's some of these things which are just errors, and you can be unlucky with the kind of things you encounter with PC gaming. But there are ways in which developers could make it easier for people, like not putting their bullshit social features between you and playing the game, which was for a period of time a real hazard in any Rockstar game, for example.
Yeah, yeah. And SOE have got this weird situation where they've insisted on going to a different publisher for the European versions of the game, which I think is one of the problems that he encountered, changing over to Proceed and Stat for PlanetSide. And it's just a bizarre measure. Like, it used to sort of make sense back when translating games was a huge deal and you needed a company to handle localization, and so MMOs would have European distributors entirely independent of their American development studios. But like, it's fucking 2013. Like, we can distribute a game across the entire world now as easily as not. you know, it's
Sony ought to have, I know it's Sony Online Entertainment, but they ought to have the resources to be able to release a game themselves in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, whatever the business decision is behind that, like, there's, it's an odd one, and it's hopefully an isolated case of what is rapidly a dying trend.
Scoo asks a quick and simple question. Has a game ever made you cry?
Yeah.
Chris, no. What game made you cry?
Mass Effect made me cry.
Oh, you big, soppy sack of shit.
I keep saying games, and you keep fucking insulting me. Dragon Age.
What?
Origins.
Yeah. Oh, that made me cry for different reasons.
Yeah, yeah. You and me have got to fucking finish business all that game. Davies. Walking Dead.
Okay, well, I can't speak to that. I don't think a game has made me cry.
I don't think a game has ever made me cry, no.
Alright.
I felt sad.
Yeah, I felt moved by games.
I mean,
but
like,
never...
I qualify crying as getting a little bit, like, moist in the eyes.
Right.
Like, not full on, like, racked with tears. I mean, like, that can happen if I just see a really beautifully rendered spaceship.
Yes, yeah.
So, like, Mass Effect, I mean, from the start, right? Like, there's no way I can see a beautiful spaceship in peril and not get a little bit choked up.
I've gotten really good tingles from Mass Effect. The tingle down the spine kind of thing of like,
I get
something fucking awesome
right,
happening.
This is a terrible
wow.
Addition.
Yeah.
This is a terrible
wow moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the wow. No, but like, so today, right, before we started recording this podcast, I made fun of the Battlefield 4 story trailer that came out today, right? Which is fucking ridiculous. And I won't go on at length about how fucking ridiculous it is, but there's a bit where a man makes a rousing speech about how the American Navy has been attacked and his boat is the only boat left, which is fucking ridiculous. He's like, we're the only boat left. And the moment he said, we're the only boat left, I got tingles. And I realized that, like, any type of last stand-based scenario completely fucks with my, like, emotional critical response, right? Like, I can no longer go, well, this is in a bullshit context, so I'm not going to feel anything.
It's probably tapping into some part of your caveman brain, like, the wolves have taken the rest of my tribe!
Yeah.
The wolves have taken down the boats, the last boat, the wolves.
Out
of the water.
And there are a series of very specific things that I have, like, hardwired emotional responses to.
Spaceships, obviously.
No,
tribal past.
Yeah, yeah. Well, spaceships is one of them, but it's mostly just the concept of ships. Like, it's mostly, like, vessels. Like, shut up.
One thing, Chris, like, specifically for you, I know warping out of...
Yeah, and I was going to get onto this. Like, things exiting hyperspace. Right? So, before... I nowadays, I don't really use, like, gamer tags anymore. Like, I don't really go for that. Like, I my Steam name is just Chris. But before that, I used to use the name Exit Warp, and that was because things exiting warp was my favourite fucking thing.
It's pretty cool.
Like, a spaceship appearing and then rapidly decelerating, like, thump.
Oh man, that's in every space game trailer at the moment, and
yeah,
it looks great each
like,
time.
Because so, I mean, yeah. It is essentially the, like, I used to love Westerns, it's the cavalry charge spaceships, right? Like, a fleet exiting hyperspace is the...
It's the last second save, that's what it is.
Yeah, it's the last second, like...
It's Gandalf turning up with the fucking, you know, water horses.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's...
Sorry.
Like, or it's the Riders of... Well, actually, or
Riders
the Riders of Rohan
yes,
moment
yeah,
in,
yeah, yeah.
When they appear above the horizon in Lord of the Rings. Like, that sort of thing.
But they don't do it at supersonic speed. If horses could warp in
yeah,
at
like,
supersonic speed,
warp,
it would be better.
Like,
horses could warp.
A warp horse.
If only.
Yeah.
If
only, yeah. Is my... Is, like, the perfect thing. And then I remember, right, and this is going to... Oh, God. Like, this is, like, a fucking rabbit hole. But, so, before I was a game journalist... I had a boring job, and when I was cycling to my boring job every day, one of the things that would occasionally occupy my brain just to tick over during the boring cycle to boring job was how the hell are they going to end Mass Effect? Like, this is days after Mass Effect 2 in the years waiting for Mass Effect 3. And I knew that I'd kind of be happy with whatever as long as there was a extended sequence of things triumphantly exiting warp.
It did deliver.
And there is. Yeah. There fucking is. There is an extended, very kind of, like, you know, a lot of things go thump in that sequence, right? There's a lot of thumping. There's just thump, 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 thump.
That was the question I wanted to ask, like, how much of it is sound design? Because when I get that tingly feeling, it's almost entirely because of sound. And there are trailers for movies or for games that I will watch more than once, and I've realized that feeling comes from sound design. Yeah, and so, like,
yeah,
there's
yeah.
a... There's a trailer for a Source Filmmaker short film that's coming out called End of the Line.
Yes.
And it's like a two-minute long trailer, or it must be less than that, a minute and a half long trailer for a short film which is going to be 8 minutes long. And it's entirely made inside Source Filmmaker by a guy who is a cinematics director at BioWare. He worked on the Dragon Age and games and Mass Effect. And it's cut to a piece of music, which is a cover version of Seven Nation Army by the White Stripes, which is like, it's based on another remix, but they've made their own version of it specifically for this trailer, because it's like a team of 8 or 9 people making this piece of machinima now. And the sound design in it throughout is incredible in terms of like characters' movements and how they grab objects from one another and machinery moving around and trains shooting across. And I've realized that the reason I get like watched this thing maybe 10 times and 7 or 8 of those times I get the tingly feeling in its sound cues.
Yeah.
And certain moments.
Yeah.
So you could really cut that to anything. It wouldn't need to be a spaceship. It could be a man where thumping his pork pie into his mouth.
Like there are film trailers now which have that whoom moment where it's just like a character opening a door.
Mulberries. Lovely.
Yeah. Popping a parliament in their mouth.
And you're completely right, because that moment of the lot of thumps, the thump moment, is also, and I said this in the podcast before, but like, it's the only moment in Mass Effect 3 when the full Mass Effect theme plays. In its sort of full triumphant form, not in the sad form from the start of the game.
I would not like to have been a tissue in your room at that time.
You never would.
All kinds of liquids could have.
Anyway,
best not.
Well, to say that, pay heed to the classic orchestral swell, which is a mathematical.
Senior's classic swell.
Yes. The orchestral swell is a classic one. And it's like a mathematically defined chord that can get louder that will just make people feel tingly and kind of like
feel ways about stuff.
Yeah, it's just the way music is.
We found a chord that made my dog howl. I wonder if it's the same basic idea.
It's the same structure. Like it could be different keys, but like the actual structure of the thing itself is it just starts quiet and then swells and gets louder and like it's hard not to emotionally react to that. It's kind of hardwired in some stupid reason. Who knows? Who knows?
And that's probably all the time we have for questions this week.
If you've got a query of your own, you can get in touch with us at Crate and Crowbar on Twitter or by emailing us questions@crateandcrowbar.com. Or if you want to follow any of us individually on Twitter, I am at Gonas, G-O-N-N-A-S.
I'm at Marsh Davies, that's D-A-V-I-E-S.
I'm Tom Senior, I'm at PCG Ludo, and Ludo is L-U-D-O.
I'm at C Thurston, that's T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N for my surname.
And this is the time when we say,
thanks for listening, everybody!